Coca-Cola Company, Keurig Dr. Pepper, and PepsiCo are bringing consumers more choices with less sugar than ever before. From sparkling flavored and bottled waters to zero sugar sports drinks, teas, and sodas, consumers are taking advantage of these choices. In fact, nearly 60% of beverages sold contain zero sugar. To learn more, visit balanceus.org.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Deborah Sue Williamson was a newly married young woman living in Lubbock, Texas on August 24, 1975. One night while her husband was away at work, she was brutally stabbed 17 times in the carport of their home. Many suspects were investigated, but no one was charged. The case went cold until the mid-1980s when Henry Lee Lucas, a man notorious for admitting to murders he didn't commit, confessed to her murder. It was profiled in the Netflix doc series, The Confession Killer. There was only one problem. He didn't kill her. Her mother and stepfather proved Lucas didn't end Debbie's life, and the case went cold once more. True crime author and investigative journalist George Jared teamed with his friend and former Army counterintelligence officer and university professor Jennifer Buchholz to study the case in depth. The two became acquainted while trying to solve the unsolved murder of Rebecca Gould. In that case, they were able to lure the man now charged with the 22-year-old woman's slaying onto a Facebook page. Their interactions with him prior to his arrest garnered national attention. Their goal was to do the same in this case. Follow their year-long journey that took them from the mountains of Colorado to the deserts of West Texas. Their investigation led them through row crop fields of the Mississippi Delta and into the rolling Ozark Hills in Missouri. The tandem was able to track down nearly every witness, person of interest, and suspect in the case. Along the way, they created a massive team of citizen detectives that have brought resources to bear on a case that is now 47 years old. The team created an investigative file many times larger than the original police file. The goal was to create a web that the killer could not escape. Silent Silhouette is an in-depth look into the work that was done, complete with full interviews of every key player in this real-life tragedy. One thing became clear as the investigation unfolded. This case is solvable, and it's only a matter of time before this killer is behind bars. The book that we're featuring this evening is Silent Silhouette, Who Killed Deborah Sue? With my special guest, investigative journalist and author, George Jared. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, George Jared.
Dan, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Nice to have you back, and congratulations on Silent Silhouette. Let's start off immediately with what happens August 24th, 1975. And when you're explaining the Sunday night, August 24th, 1975 in Lubbock, Texas, introduce Bob Lemon, his wife Joyce, Elizabeth, Liz, who's 8 years old, and Sue Williamson. And she had just married her fiance, Doug, earlier that summer. So if you could, and they also had spent that summer in Buffalo Springs, near Buffalo Springs Lake. So tell us about all these friends and the family connections and what they did the day before with some of those same people. Introduce some of those people.
Sure. So Deborah Sue Williamson was 18 years old. She was a newlywed. She had just married her husband, Doug, in June of that year. And so they were married for roughly 10 weeks. The day before the murder, They had gone out to Buffalo Springs Lake. It's a recreational area just outside of Lubbock, Texas. Debbie was an avid water skier, and so they went out. They had some friends that were with them, another couple, Mike and Dorothy Coffin. They were recently married as well. They had a guy named Paul, who Debbie had sort of dated before Doug, and Paul was also good friends with Doug. They had been friends for years. And there was another guy named Lex. He was just another friend. Debbie and he had actually gone to prom together, I think maybe when she was a junior, but they went as friends. It was just kind of a friend thing. And so there was a group of people out there, and there were more people out at the lake, but those are the primary people that we know of. They were all out there water skiing. So fast forward to the night of the murder, around 7 o'clock that night, Debbie is picked up at her house by her stepdad, Bob Lemons, and her mother, Joyce, and her sister, Elizabeth Liz. They decide to go to the Pizza Inn where Doug is the manager. And Paul, the friend, actually had just been hired as a cook there. So they go around 7 o'clock. At one point, they get a little busy and they needed change for the register. So Debbie actually left and went and got change from, we're not sure where she went to go get the change from, but she brought the change back. And then around 8:15-ish, she leaves with her family. They take her back to her house. Her and Doug lived in a house on the south end of town. It was kind of a rural area, but it was in the city limits. The house was actually the house that Doug grew up in. His parents had moved to another house, and when they got married, they gave his childhood home to them as a house to live in. And so they drop her off around probably 8:30-ish. They go back to their house. Around 9 o'clock, Doug calls and says, hey, we're getting pretty busy. And she was supposed to return to the Pizza Inn that night anyway, because Doug had borrowed $140 from the cash register earlier in the week by a CB radio. Now, it was kind of like an IOU system there, and it was acceptable to do that, but the money had to be, the register had to be reconciled before the end of the business week, which the business week would have ended that Sunday night.
Right.
So she had $140 in her purse that she was supposed to take back up there, and it was also inventory night. So Lex, Paul, Doug, and Debbie were supposed to do inventory that night. So she was going to come back and help with that. So she told Doug when he called that she was going to finish watching her show, which we believe is the movie The Odd Couple. That's what the TV was turned to. It ended around 9:30 that night. But Daniel, remember back in those days, you would have the feature movie of the week. And then normally the movie would actually end around 9:15-ish. Then they would have a very long commercial break. And then they would preview the movie or whatever was going to be shown the next week. And so that's kind of how it was back in those times. So realistically, around 9:15, she could have been walking out the door. Well, 10 o'clock comes, no Debbie. Doug starts calls his house. He calls Mike and Dorothy, the couple that they'd gone out with the day before. He calls Bob and Joyce. No one knows where Debbie's at. Again, it's 1975. There's no cell phones. Obviously, it's a different time. You know, people could be out of pocket and it wouldn't have been suspicious, you know. But then 11 o'clock comes. She doesn't show up. Midnight comes. They shut the store down. And then finally at 1 o'clock, he tells Marianne, the waitress who's been working with him all night, I'm going to go home and check on Debbie. I got to see what's going on here. So he leaves. As he's leaving, Paul is coming back to the Pizza Inn. Paul had asked to leave earlier to go on a date. So he left around 8:45 that night. And so as Doug leaves, Paul is coming back in. And then their friend Lex had been there probably for about an hour and a half just waiting. And Lex didn't work at the Pizza Inn. Lex would come and help them do things at the store. And then Doug would like give him a pizza. It was one of those kind of arrangements. So it was just kind of helping a friend out. And then he would get a free pizza out of the deal. So Marianne, the waitress, Paul and Lex are there. Doug drives to his home. He immediately notices something that is amiss. The back door is wide open. So he gets out of his car. He starts to walk up to the back step and he stumbles upon Debbie's body. She had been stabbed 17 times. Her pants had been pulled down and her shirt had been pulled up to make it look like she'd been raped. But later, her autopsy indicated that she had not been sexually assaulted. The kitchen window right above or right near the porch had been knocked out with a garden hoe. It was kind of strange because the back door was left wide open and this window, most like even an average sized man, it'd be really hard for him to fit through there. And it's kind of high, so it would be hard to get in there. And then if you do go through the window, there's a kitchen sink right there. So that was obviously a ruse. It was just trying to throw the investigators off, especially since there was also a sliding glass door right there. If you're going to shatter a door, you could shatter that and walk right through it. So Doug panics. He gets back into his car. He drives back to the Pizza Inn, which the Pizza Inn was only about probably 4 minutes away. So it wasn't that far. He comes back He goes inside and he tells them, he said, Debbie's been raped. And so he gets on the phone and he tells the dispatcher that his wife has been raped and that he needs a police officer now. Lex and Paul jump into Lex's car. They drive out there and Lex actually checks Debbie for a pulse. And of course, she's obviously dead. And then Doug arrives moments later and then they wait for the police. A little bit later that night, not much later, Bob and Joyce show up. Interesting thing about Bob is Bob, at this point in his life, was legally blind. He couldn't even drive. And as soon as he finds out that something's happened to Debbie, they're trying to keep him away. He quite literally knocked two police officers to the ground and rushed to her. And then he said for the rest of his life, he immediately regretted that decision because he saw her. And so that's how this odyssey started.
Paul Neal, let's go back to Doug, who he was the assistant manager, Paul Neal, but he had only been working for a couple weeks with Doug. He had spent the summer and missed the wedding between Debbie and Doug. And some questioned that he'd been working out of town, but it was odd. Some people thought that he had missed this wedding. At 8 o'clock, he had asked Doug if he could leave and go on a date. He had shown up for work, clocked in after 5 o'clock. Tell us about why he was asking to leave and the timeline of when he actually did leave.
So Paul Neal, he dated Debbie and then she split up with him to go out with Doug. And it's pretty obvious that he was upset by this. It was in the contemporaneous police reports that we were able to get our hands on that they talked to him about this several times. Joyce, the mom, had said, you know, that at one point Paul even asked Joyce, you know, why doesn't Debbie love me? And so there was obviously some friction there when she decided to date one of his best friends. And so he was not invited to their wedding. I guess it had been contentious enough. Even actually, since we wrote the book, we've actually had a couple more witnesses approach us that we didn't even know about who could speak to it a little bit more. And so Paul was out of town all summer working, I think like in the oil fields or something like that in Texas. Well, a couple of weeks before the murder, he comes back to town and Doug hires him to be an assistant manager slash cook at the Pizza Inn. And so on the night of the murder, he's there cooking. Well, at 8 o'clock, he asked Doug, he said, hey, can I leave early? I've got a date with a woman named Tina. And Doug says, that's fine. And Doug didn't have a problem with it because the manager's bonus there, the way the system worked, he got a bigger bonus every month, depending on how much money he saved on labor. So letting him go on a Sunday night was actually perfect because they're normally not busy. So when Paul's interviewed by police a couple days later, they ask him, they say, so when did you leave? He said, I left at 9:10. And then he arrived for his date with Tina at around 10 o'clock.
Right.
The problem is that we got a copy of his time card and his time card said he clocked out at 8:43. And so that's a difference of almost 30 minutes. Another thing happened right around the time that he ended up leaving too. Remember, I told you that Doug had called Debbie to tell her that they were busy and that he may need some help and she needed to maybe come early.
Right.
Well, there was one other thing that Doug had to talk to her about.
Yes.
Paul asked Doug if he could take a shower at their house. And his reasoning was that Debbie and Doug's house was much closer to Tina's house, the woman he was going on a date with. And so he wanted to know if he could go by there and take a shower. Well, Doug told Debbie this, and this is one thing we don't know for certain. We don't know if, because Paul said at the time, he said, well, if she's there by herself, I don't want to go there. He said that, but we don't know that Debbie knew that he wasn't coming because we think Doug just told her, hey, Paul's going to swing by and take a shower.
Right.
And so this detail really jumped out to us because we thought it was very odd. I've asked a lot of people, and again, not blaming anybody, not saying it, that he had anything to do with it, but I haven't found anybody who could plausibly come up with a reason why an ex-boyfriend would be coming over to take a shower at a married woman's house.
You talked to Tina McBride, the date that he went on that night, and it was a very enlightening conversation you had with her. Tell us what she noted, what was the timeline for her when he had called her about the date. Give us those details and the description of his appearance and his behavior by Tina.
Sure. So tracking her down was a challenge. She lives in the middle of nowhere. She lives out in the Texas desert. So at one point when we went to Lubbock in August of 2021, she was on not at the top of our list of people, but she was one of the people that we really wanted to talk to.
Right.
And so we finally found an address for her and it was out in the middle of nowhere. Like I drove my car like 8 miles down it's not even a gravel road. It was a trail. And there were oil jacks bobbing up and down. There was, you know, I don't know what if the terms, vistas, you know, yes. it was like a desert, you know, tumbleweeds, one-eyed Susans everywhere, cows everywhere. So we get to their house and her husband was outside playing with a dog in their front yard, beautiful ranch style house. And he looked at me kind of weird. He was looking at my car. I know he was thinking, how in the world did you get this card here? And so we said, can we talk to Tina? And he goes, well, yeah, she's inside making lunch. And so we open the door. And as soon as she sees us, she says, you want to talk about Deborah Sue Williamson, don't you? And we said, yes. And she goes, and you want to know how Paul Neal acted that night? And we said, yes. And so she invited us into her home and we sat and talked to her for a couple hours. She said she was very agitated that night. And Dan, the thing of it is that I told Jennifer this later. I said, I was watching her body language. And even all these years later, I could tell that she was aggravated that he was late picking her up because they were supposed to go on a date. He was supposed to arrive before 10 o'clock and he didn't. And when he did arrive, she said he was covered in water. He was soaked like he had just got out of the shower. And she said he didn't smell like pizza at all. Like he had really scrubbed himself off. And so they get in his car and they're driving around and he did not want to go. Like she worked part time at that Pizza Inn and she was getting ready to go to college at Texas A&M, like going to leave the next week. So she wanted to go by there. And, you know, it was a thing to do in the 70s. You go hang out in parking lots at, you know, restaurants and stuff like that. And so she wanted to go to Pizza Inn because she knew people there and people who hung out around there at night. He wanted to go to the McDonald's down the street and he would not go to the Pizza Inn. So that was aggravating her. And she also said that he was acting very, very nervous.
You talk about, too, that the timeline that he told her or she said that he had called and said he was still at work was 9:30. So very, very interesting development there.
Yes, I forgot about that detail, Dan. So he called her at 9:30 and said that he was still at work. That's correct. And so, and again, this was in the contemporaneous police reports. You know, one advantage that we had in this case was because of the Henry Lee Lucas fiasco that you noted at the beginning, the Lubbock Police Department or the DA, not the Lubbock Police Department, but the DA in the case got really aggravated with Bob Lemons because they had fought so hard to prove that Henry Lee Lucas didn't kill the daughter.
Right.
Well, there was a moment where Bob was sitting across a desk from the DA and the DA had the entire case file sitting in front of him. And he pushed the entire thing to Bob and says something to the effect of, well, if you don't think we can solve it, maybe you can. And so Bob took the entire case file. And so the family has had this case file since then. So this provided us access to the original reports.
Now, the Lubbock, Texas, how police responded to this is obviously part of your investigation. Almost all the people that you were able to interview were interviewed by police. But as you write, that despite anything, they were never re-interviewed again. People like Tina was interviewed once, and some of these interviews were very brief. And so tell us about your investigation. And as you write, there was how you and Jennifer and your relationship plays into this. So explain your working relationship with Jennifer Buchholz and how it contributed to this investigation greatly.
So Jennifer and I became friends back in 2019. She was a counterintelligence agent in the U.S. Army. Her job was basically to She worked in Afghanistan, South Korea, some places like that. And her job was to vet people who work on these bases to see if they're terrorists or not. And she was very good at what she did. But when she got out of the Army, she became a professor of criminology at AMU University in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And she had heard me on a podcast talking about the Rebecca Gould murder case. So she contacted me. Her and I became fast friends. And we noticed that, like, I'm an investigative journalist. I'm a true crime author. I have certain skills. And like, she has like, her skill set's exactly the opposite of mine in a lot of ways. So we actually were pretty good partners like that. So we formed a Facebook page in Rebecca's case to make a long story short. And we were able to lure a guy named William Miller onto this page. Rebecca was a 22-year-old college student who was murdered on September 20th, 2004 in Melbourne, Arkansas. The case went unsolved for 16 years. Well, we lured this guy onto the page and he started communicating with us. And again, to make a long story short, it turns out that this guy was the first cousin of her sort of ex-boyfriend. And she was actually murdered in the sort of ex-boyfriend's home. It was kind of an on again, off again relationship. She had stayed the weekend at his house. Well, Monday morning, she took the boyfriend to work, allegedly, and then returned to his home to get her dog and her clothes and all this other stuff so she could make her return trip to college. And that's when she vanished. And so this guy was talking to us, and we pretty quickly knew there was something off with this guy. And this went on for probably about 8 or 9, 10 months. We sent the messages to the police. Well, they started looking at him as a serious candidate, you know, like someone who might be involved in the murder. And then on November 7th, 2020, a detective flew to Oregon and interviewed him. He was visiting his mom and brother there. William Miller actually lived on a plantation in the Philippines. He had married a Filipino woman, and so he moved there. He worked on oil and gas rigs around the world. And so he would rarely come back to the United States, but during this visit, this police officer interrogated him, and he confessed to the murder. And so in 2021, we were asked to do a presentation at CrimeCon about our interactions with William Miller on our Facebook page. And at this point, you know, he's been charged with murder. We're getting ready for his trial. It starts on Halloween Day here in a couple of weeks. And so our idea was, you know, and Jennifer was like, well, Rebecca's case is kind of in limbo right now. Do you want to try to do this with some other case? And so we had him, and I said, yes. Like, we thought maybe we could lure this person out of hiding, or lure somebody who knows something out of hiding. And so we were approached by Debbie's sister, Liz, and she gave us all of the contemporaneous files. And we decided, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to go all the way. We went to Lubbock for a week, and we actually went on the week of the anniversary of the death. Mm-hmm. So we actually went to the house the night of the murder. We were there the actual moment when it happened. The homeowner was gracious, let us in, let us do experiments. You know, we took measurements. We're trying to figure out, you know, like, could we possibly figure out how tall the perpetrator was based on the wound pattern on her body? You know, right. But hard to do that without. And it was so ironic because when we went there, it was all the original stuff. Like, the door frame was the same. On the back porch, nothing had changed. It was the same concrete, same flower bed. I will say this, the homeowner, before we actually talked to him, we were outside, like in the alley, and it was dark, and he did have a rifle pointed at us at one point for a while. Wow. So I had to, I took him a nice gift basket the next day to tell him, thank you for not shooting any of us.
Yeah.
But so that's kind of how we got this started. And so we created a spreadsheet of every single person that the police had interviewed originally. And originally they had honed in on Debbie's brother because he has a drug history and apparently he had smacked her on the face the year before. But the problem with it was, and Jennifer is an expert in behavioral analysis, and the first thing that she said, she goes, I don't think a brother is going to pull his sister's pants down and pull her shirt up. I just can't see him doing that. I said, I think you're right. And also, you know, he had a pretty solid alibi. He had three other alibi witnesses, and two of them were married women who had a lot. I mean, it seems as if they would have a lot of reason to lie about where they were, you know, because they obviously were not hanging out with their husbands. And so, but they said that where they were out bar hopping that night. And we kind of feel like they just honed in on him just because he was a criminal and he was close to her. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he did have a very troubled life, and he ended up taking his own life in 1990. He did have a lot of trouble with drugs. And unfortunately, Debbie's own mother, actually, after that Netflix series, The Confession Killer, right after it aired, she took her life as well. So they have some of that in their family. And so we created a spreadsheet. We tracked down, I mean, you know, we tracked down Doug, the girl that Doug went out with right before he went out with Debbie, because she was very, her and Doug were going to get married. And then Doug split up with her and then ended up getting with Debbie. And there was some consternation there. And we went to her house, her husband, we sat down, talked to her, and we said, look, you would be a natural suspect. And she goes, oh, I know. She goes, I talked to the police. And she goes, I cared very deeply about Doug, but I could never do that to someone else. And her story checked out. I mean, she had a pretty solid alibi as well. So we were satisfied with that. You know, one of the things that we noticed in our analysis is we got a knife expert, and the wounds on her body, we're not saying that a female couldn't have done it, but it's very likely that it was a male who stabbed her. And so that kind of helped us narrow our focus a little bit. Our knife expert also told, as soon as he saw the wounds, we showed him the autopsy photos. As soon as he saw the wounds, he said, I know exactly what knife was used. And we're like, well, what was it? He goes, it's a military style dagger that was made by the U.S. military from 1943 to 1946. And a lot of guys who served at Normandy were issued this particular type of dagger. It has a very special kind of hilt. And just so people know what a hilt is, that's the stopper. Like when you have a knife, it's the thing that stops your hand from going down the blade when you're stabbing something. So So we started looking at all the people who were interviewed as original suspects. Do they have any connections to the U.S. military? And did they serve in World War II? Well, it turns out that several of these people, you know, including, you know, guys like Paul and Lex and all those guys, they all had relatives, you know, dads and uncles and whatnot who served, some of them actually at Normandy. So these knives would have been, you know, readily accessible to a lot of different people in this case. And, you know, and one thing about like a military style dagger, when you're getting stabbed, you know, a question that we would get often was, did anybody show up with like wounds on their hands or arms? Because that's very common when you're stabbing someone, blood gets on it, it starts getting slippery.
Yes.
Think about a military style dagger, though. It's designed with that in mind. It's a killing weapon. And so it's designed to where it's more sturdy. Because, and Dan, you know this, and a lot of stabbings, the blade will break off in the victim, you know, as they're being stabbed. So, and none of that was a fact in this case. So we tracked those people down. We tracked down the best man and his wife, you know, from the wedding. He had never been interviewed by police to this day. They've never talked to him. And we couldn't believe it because he was friends with all the people that they were talking to. Mm-hmm. And he's also the best. He's Doug's best friend at the time. And so we feel like, you know, if there was something going on, you know, that we would, he might be someone that Doug might have confided something to, you know what I mean? So we tracked him down. He had never been interviewed by police. And it was interesting, too, because I was talking to him and he said that when they figured out, now, when Debbie's purse got taken during the attack, inside her purse was a little, it's like a proof book of their wedding. And back in those days, you would have these little proof books and people would look through them and they could order pictures.
Right.
Well, the day before the funeral, they decided that they needed to get some wedding photos from the house. And so this best man and Lex and Paul, they go back to the house because Doug can't. He told me, he said, I was too out of it. He goes, I didn't want to go in there. It just bothered me so bad. So they go, and that's when they figured out that this little like proof book was missing. And so we found a police report because they said the best man said that they went and found a police officer because they were scared to go in the house. Well, we found a police report where the police officer actually was at a donut shop, just like the best man said. His recollection was spot on with what contemporaneous report from 1975. Another person that we obviously wanted to track down was Doug. And so I got a cell phone number for him and I called Doug and I said, Doug, my name is George Jared. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author. And my investigative partner and I, Jennifer Buchholz, we're looking into your former wife's murder case. And he was very receptive to that. We started chatting. And ironically enough, he actually moved to after Debbie's murder, he moved to a town in the Mississippi Delta. It's a town called Jonesboro. And he went to Arkansas State University and got a teaching degree there. And he was on the bowling team with a guy named Bob Trout. Well, I worked at the Jonesboro Sun as a reporter for years, and the Trouts actually owned that newspaper for a very long time. And I asked Doug, you know, when I was talking to him the first time, I noticed he had a Missouri number. And I said, Doug, do you live in Missouri? And he goes, yeah. He goes, I live in a little town you've never heard of. It's called Donovan. Well, I've been to Donovan many times. I've been through there a lot. And I said, well, you're only about an hour and 15 minutes from me right now. So I actually took my podcast producer and I, a week later, actually went to his house and interviewed him for several hours. And, you know, we asked him about all of these people. And I'll say this, Dan, he acknowledged that he was the primary suspect from the very beginning.
Right.
And he goes, and I understand why. He goes, I'm the husband. He goes, it makes total sense. He took a polygraph. He passed it. And then also his alibi, you know, was that he was at work all night. Well, that was supported by a couple of things. Number one, Marianne actually tracked us down, the waitress.
Right.
And she told us, she said, he did not leave. He could not have left because it was only the two of us at that point. I could not have cooked, ran the register, and waited on tables. There's no way I could have done it. He didn't leave. And I asked Marianne, you know, some tough questions, you know, and one of them was, okay, what was your relationship with Doug? Did you have some type of romantic relationship with him where you might have covered for him? And she said, absolutely not. She said they only worked together for about a month. She said he was always very nice to her, that he always Debbie would come up there periodically and sit and wait on him. And she said they were just a nice little couple. And she said no. And also there was something else in the police reports that also supported the hypothesis that Doug didn't leave. There was no deposit made. They were required in that company to do a nightly deposit around 9:30. Well, the deposit wasn't made. So at the very least, if he left, he would have done a deposit. So we're pretty confident that he did not leave that night.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity, George, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. Did you know there are currently over 2.4 million podcasts in the world, including the one you're listening to right now? And it takes a team of people to help bring these podcasts together. As my longtime listeners know, the True Murder podcast team has just been me. But this year, because of ZipRecruiter, I found True Murder's audio engineer and editor, Evan Gardner. He's also working on archived episodes and even organizing the True Murder podcast YouTube channel. Evan takes care of everything technical so I can concentrate just on the interviews. Needless to say, hiring the right people for these roles is important. And whether you're hiring for a podcast or for your growing business, there's only one place that makes it easy, ZipRecruiter. And now you can try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that makes it easy to filter, review, and rate your candidates. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you want to try ZipRecruiter for free today, you need to remember our special URL, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, you talked to Doug, and again, it seems plausible that he can't be involved because he didn't even leave, and then his reaction was very ordinary. Some people talked about that he, as soon as he came back to that Pizza Inn, he said, Deborah has been raped. But you explain that that's not so uncommon for people to underestimate the magnitude of what they have just witnessed. But let's talk about some serious suspects in this, based on their behavior, based on discrepancies when you spoke to them, and this one being Paul Neal. And tell us about, because you talk about that Bob Lemons was able to go inside that house and found a couple wet towels in Debbie's home. And the other idea was that he said to police that he had showered at his parents' home, but they weren't there. But were his parents questioned? And now when you mentioned about the knife and the military connection, would have it been interesting for the police to check if there was any connection with the knife and Neil's father in this case?
Yeah. To our knowledge, his parents were never interviewed. And it's really a slip up in the original investigation, because essentially he alibied himself for the time of the murder, and which is, you know, nowadays that could never happen. But as far as we know, they were never interviewed. So his story is that he didn't go to Debbie and Doug's, that he went to his own home, his parents' house, and he showered there. Nobody was home. And then he went from there on the date with Tina. Now, the problem is that it took him, he basically arrived at Tina's house at the same time as if he didn't take off early from work. And, you know, because he gets there around 10. Well, he was supposed to, his shift ended at 10. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really save any time, even though he took off an hour and 17 minutes early. So that's problematic. And again, we're not accusing him of anything, but this is a discrepancy. And also, he told the police one thing and his time card says something else. So that's a discrepancy. Another discrepancy with him is when he and Lex go back to the to check on Debbie after Doug arrives at the Pizza Inn, he says that they go into the house to see if the killer or killers are still in there. Well, Lex and his police report said they didn't go in the house. So automatically, within 24 hours of the murder, you've got two witnesses at the scene who are telling two different stories, and going into the house or not going into the house is a pretty dramatic difference. And also, another interesting little tidbit with Lex is that for some reason, when he was interviewed by police, Paul says he clocked out at 9:10. They asked Doug, they said, Doug, when did he leave? And Doug said, I think he left around 9. Well, then they asked Lex Brown, who doesn't work there, by the way. They said, well, when did Paul leave the Pizza Inn? And he said 8:45. So of these three guys, two of the three worked there. One of them is the person. Lex knew exactly when he left. And we couldn't, still haven't quite figured out what happened, because there's only a couple of possibilities. Was he there when Paul left? Well, according to the original police reports, Lex didn't arrive until around 10:30 or 11. Did he look at his time card? You know, which would be just odd. I mean, why would you be looking at a time card for someone who works at a, you know, a business that you don't even work at? Or maybe during their conversation, Paul had told him he left around 8:45. So we don't know. So that was one of the mystery that we still haven't been able to unravel. And so the towels are interesting because we believe they were collected in evidence. And I had a theory, Dan, early on. Because there was no reports of anybody with any blood, no bloody clothes, none of that stuff from anybody that night in Lubbock, Texas. And so I was sitting there thinking to myself, okay, she stabbed on the back carport. The back door is open. Is it possible that the killer went into the house and took a shower? Because there were wet towels in the guest bathroom and those towels were collected. So is it possible that the killer's DNA is on those towels? You know, and I'm friends with Jared Bradley, who's the, you know, the CEO of MVAC DNA testing. And towels, you know, I've talked to him several times, and towels would be, you know, a great place to collect, you know, skin DNA. So it is possible, if those towels are still in evidence, that the killer's DNA, if they went in the house and took a shower, which I think they did, that could explain a lot of that.
You talk about all kinds of behavior and odd statements to other people, but also when you interviewed Paul Neal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in regards to whether he entered that house or not. Tell us what he asked you in regards to whether the killer went into the house or not, and what you think that really represents in terms of why he is asking that question.
So we interviewed him twice, actually. The first time, Jennifer called him at work out of the blue, and he answered. And one of the first things that he wanted to know was if the police were ever able to determine if the killer had actually gone in the house. And he asked this several times. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know why he was asking it, but he was. And then later on, when he called me, he actually called me and asked me the same question. He goes, and he said something like, well, they've obviously already DNA tested all that stuff. And I said, no, Paul, they haven't tested anything yet. We're working on that right now to get everything tested. And so one thing that he did tell me, there was a couple of inconsistent things he said. Number one, he said that he didn't date Debbie. He said they might have went out for a drink or something like that. And I was like, well, no, that's not true. You guys were in high school. You know, she graduated from high school in May of that year. And when you guys had sort of dated, you guys weren't legally of legal age to drink. So that didn't happen. When he tried to deny that he had a relationship with her, that was very odd to me because it was clearly obvious that they had a relationship. Another thing that he told me that I thought was odd was that I did a podcast episode where I talked about the touch DNA possibly being on the towels and all this other stuff. Well, shortly after I do that episode, he actually called me. I had tried to call him and text him several times, and he would not respond to any of my messages. And then so after this podcast episode comes out, I get a call from him. And during this conversation, I said, so did you ask to go take a shower the night before? And he denied. He said, I can't remember. I don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. Then he tells me a story about how he took a shower in that house the day before, on August 23rd, 1975. And his direct quote to me was, I'd been in that bathroom many times through the years. I spent a lot of time in that bathroom. And that was his direct quote. Yeah. And I was like, so how did you remember taking a shower there the day before, but you didn't remember asking to take a shower there the night of? And the reason that it was odd to me was because the police asked Doug. They said, so your friend wanted to take a shower at your house. Doug's response in the police reports was, well, he had just taken one there yesterday. He's done this all the time. All Doug says, well, I'm not sure why he would want to take a shower there. He didn't say any of that other stuff, because you would think if he had just taken a shower there the day before, he'd say, well, he did it yesterday.
Sure.
And Dan, this is going to sound a little creepy, but I actually know where he took a shower on August 23rd, 1975, years before I was born. He actually took a shower at Debbie's parents' house. They had a cabin on Buffalo Lake. Mm. And after they all got done water skiing that day, the whole group of them went back to that house and got cleaned up. And then Paul and Doug actually went to the Pizza Inn to work that Saturday night.
Now, you talk about Lex, and very interesting why either one of these people would want to go to the crime scene after Doug said, listen, Deborah's been raped. And then one other thing that you mentioned in the book as well is that Lex was told something by Doug, and Paul asked Lex what Doug had said. What was that detail that was mentioned?
when Doug came back into the Pizza Inn, and I asked Doug about this too. I said, Doug, you knew she was dead, right? He goes, oh yeah, I knew. He said, I may have said that she was raped, but deep down inside, I knew that she was gone. And I said, okay. And that's and Dan, you know this, that's a very common reaction. When a child is kidnapped, when the 911 call is made, the parent doesn't go, my kid's been kidnapped, because kidnapped has a connotation of never seeing the kid again. It's my child is missing. Mm-hmm. I can't find my child. You know, well, other than in JonBenet Ramsey's case, I guess, because her parents did say that she was kidnapped. Yeah. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. So when he comes into the Pizza Inn, Doug says that she's been raped. And then Paul asks Lex, what did Doug just say? And so that's when the two of them jump in the car and then they head over to where her body is. And another interesting little tidbit that came out that we found in the original contemporaneous reports, about a week after the murder, Doug reports that a spare set of keys that belonged to Debbie had gone missing from Joyce's purse.
Right.
Joyce had kept this spare, it was like her car, her spare car keys, house keys, all these keys. And so on, I think it was September 4th, maybe, this report is made that these keys are missing. We can't find them anywhere. And then on September 10th, Doug and Paul go to the Lemons' house. They're sitting on the couch in the living room. They get up and leave. The next morning, Joyce finds that set of keys underneath a cushion where Paul was sitting. And they immediately go to the police with it, immediately go down there and said that they found these keys. And I asked Paul about it, and he goes, yeah, I don't really remember that. I mean, he really didn't seem to remember anything, you know, that pertained to him. He did tell me that he had taken a couple of polygraph tests. He knows he failed one. He's not sure how he did on the other one. You know, going back to Tina, you know, she didn't see him for about a month after the murders because she went to college. Well, she came back for a football game and she ran into him and she said he looked like he lost 25 or 30 pounds. Right. So he was obviously under a great deal of stress in September of 1975 because he was being questioned by the police actually several times. Also, another interesting thing that Tina told us was that his dad would call her when she was in college and would record her telling the story of what happened that night over and over again.
Incredible.
And it was just really odd, you know, and he told her and she said he was really nice. I said, had you ever met this guy? And she goes, no, I never met him in my life. Did not know him, never met him. And I said, how many times do you think he called you? And she goes, oh, at least half a dozen times. And he told her that he was recording it. And he told her that, you know, the reason he was doing that was because she might bump her head sometime and forget, you know, what happened. So we thought that was very odd as well.
What do you find police make of this discrepancies and holes in Paul Neal's timeline? He leaves at 8:43 officially. He calls Tina and he calls her and she says at 9:30, they're supposed to be the date. He picks her up at 10. He drops her off at 12, but he shows up for the inventory. Curiously, Pizza Inn closes at 12. But he shows up for inventory after Doug leaves, almost immediately, you write, at 1 a.m. So what do police make of Paul Neal's statements? And as a result, what do they do? What did you find?
As of right now, I mean, we have been in constant communication with the head of the CID division with the Lubbock Police Department. He's always been very responsive to our emails. We gave him a jump drive with every bit of our investigation, every interview we did, every person we tracked down. We even gave him, we've had people analyze like her autopsy report and the stabbing pictures. We actually made a second trip to Lubbock in March of this year, and we took a dummy that was proportional to like Debbie's height and size, you know, just to see if we could figure anything out. Because Dan, I'll tell you something interesting about the wound pattern on her body. Most of the wounds were clean, meaning there was no jagged edge to them, meaning she was either unconscious or subdued when most of the knife wounds when she was stabbed.
Interesting.
So we couldn't figure that out. Like, why was she not fighting off her attacker? Well, when we did the dummy experiment, we figured out something pretty quickly. There's one wound to her body that could be fatal in and of itself. Without actually examining her body, we couldn't know for certain, but she was stabbed underneath her armpit on her left armpit. And it is very possible that that knife got in between the bones in her upper chest. It's very possible, and it could have pierced her heart. And so we started studying that a little bit because we're like, did he actually deliver the fatal blow with the first one? And what's interesting is we know the attack started by the back porch and she ran about 25 feet and then collapsed near the end of the carport at the end of her car because there's a large pool of blood there. Then the killer dragged her back to the back porch where he, I guess the only way to say it is, displayed her. When we did the dummy experiment, we figured out, what if she was confronted coming out the door? Someone is confronting her. She sticks her left hand up, say, get away from me. Don't talk to me. I don't want anything to do with you. And the killer has that knife along his forearm. And our knife expert showed us exactly how you could conceal a knife. And Dan, it was almost scary how easy it was to conceal such a large knife, but he could have done it. And then that person stabs her through the armpit and delivers a fatal blow. And then she can, and then we did some research on it. She could have gotten, if that went down like that, and we found cases where that's happened. And usually the person can get 20, 25 feet away and then they collapse. They just pass out.
The other thing is when you talked about her being posed and displayed, with her genitals exposed, with her breasts exposed, that's also a sort of a retribution, a revenge towards someone as well. And you say likely the killer would know that Doug would find her. And Doug had made statements as well to say that the killer certainly must have known that he was at work, the routine, and familiar with the property itself, again, pointing to Paul Neal. But in this regard as well, you had to speak to everybody, and Lex being a friend of everyone, including Paul and Doug and everyone else, you tried to contact him. Very, very interesting denials he made in terms of not being able to speak, but you did communicate somewhat through a texter, through text messaging. Very, very interesting, the statements that were made via that texter. Can you explain?
Sure. So we tried to get a hold of Lex a lot. It's not just us, because we understand if he doesn't want to talk to me. I'm an investigative journalist. You know, that can be a turnoff for a lot of people. You know, Jennifer, you know, she's a criminology professor. He doesn't know us. We get that. The problem is that he refuses to return calls from family members. And so we were getting, I don't want to say aggravated, but it was just weird and suspicious that he wouldn't talk to us. So this person who is related to him, and we refer to her in the book, or him in the book, as the texter, because we don't know if it was him texting or someone else. We just know that phone legally belongs to him. We verified that. And so this person was texting us and saying, well, he told the police everything back in 1975. And if they didn't do their job, that's not his fault.
Right.
And so the implication is if the police had done their job, then there would have been an arrest, and it would be chained to something that Lex said, mm-hmm. or, you know, something to that effect. So he will not contact us. And what's interesting is that we actually talked to a person who knew him for years after the murder. And Debbie's murder is kind of a famous murder in that town, unsolved. And this person contacted us and said, you know, I had a really weird conversation with him one time where, you know, we were talking about the murder of Deborah Sue Williamson, and he never once mentioned that he was friends with her and actually was the one that checked her for a pulse when she was found. And this person vividly remembered all the people that were involved in the conversation. And this person said he never said a word about it ever. And we were just like, really? That is so bizarre. And so, I mean, Lex and Paul were best friends at the time. And again, we're not accusing him of anything. He may know nothing. It's very possible. It's just there's a behavior pattern here that we can't understand.
George, this is just as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Explain about the keys as well, pointing to Paul Neal in terms of the stolen spare car key and house keys and where they were found. Can you explain this?
Sure. So there was a set of car keys, a spare set of keys that was reported missing. Joyce had it in her purse. It went missing. They looked everywhere. And Dan, you remember this. You know, back in the 70s, 80s, even 90s, if your car keys were missing, the first place you looked was the couch, right? I mean,
sure.
That's where you found all your extra change. And that's where you found your car keys. I mean, that's just the way it went back in those days. And so we know that they looked all over for these keys before they reported them missing to the police. So when Doug and Paul visit on September 10th, 6 days after the keys are reported missing to the police, and we have the police report, Doug and Paul sit on the couch. Well, after they leave that night from the Lemons home, Joyce finds the keys underneath the cushion that Paul was sitting on. And again, we're not accusing anybody of anything, but it's just a weird detail. And so they immediately go to police and say, this was found under the cushion that he was sitting on. And Paul denied taking the keys. He said he had no idea why they would be under a cushion where he was sitting. But it is a detail I think that is important because, as like I said, you wouldn't report those keys missing if you hadn't looked everywhere in the first place.
Now, with all the information that you brought forward, you talk about the meetings that you had with Lubbock Police Department, which included family members, Liz and Paula, and also Jennifer as well. Tell us about these meetings and how supportive were they in your endeavors? And what did they state that they would do in cooperation with the evidence that you were bringing towards them in terms of retesting?
So they said that they would try to track down all the evidence or case. I don't think they have all of it. Now, they wouldn't tell us specifically what they had. I don't think they had it all in one location because this has been handled by multiple agencies.
Okay.
And so I think that, you know, the Texas Rangers had it for a while. Lubbock PD had it for a while. The Texas Department of Public Safety. It's essentially another, like, you know, police agency there in Texas. They had it. So what they told us is that they would try to track down all the evidence and then they would try to get as much of it tested as they possibly could for DNA. Now, they did tell us, you know, from the beginning, hey, you know, we probably won't be able to really release the results to you guys. And we were fine with that. We said, just as long as you're doing it, we don't care. And to this point, we haven't gotten anything back from them. I mean, we would assume they would at least tell us that the testing had happened, and that hasn't happened yet. I mean, we communicated with the head of the CID division yesterday, quite literally sent him an email yesterday about, you know, because we did form a Facebook page and there are people who comment on there. And Paul Neal admitted to me that he's on there under an alias. So he's on there. We know all the other, you know, players and people who are connected. This is what we know. We send everything to the Lubbock PD and we just hope that they are working on it and do the right thing. As of right now, we know that they've on the periphery talked to a few people, like they've called and done some interviews. We don't know how extensive that is yet, because for obvious reasons, a lot of these people won't talk to us anymore, and which is fine, probably wouldn't talk to us either after all this. So we don't know where the state of the investigation is. We're hopeful. And this is the thing, Dan, this case is probably going to be solved through good old fashioned police work. It's going to be a detective pounding the dirt, going out and figuring out whoever killed Deborah Sue Williamson has told someone else, someone knows. And what we have to do is we have to figure out a way to capture that person and get them to tell the story to police.
How obvious, though, I'm reading this book, how right from the very beginning, Paul Neal seems to be my main suspect. And with this, with the interview that you had with him, which is included in the book, he becomes more and more suspicious. When you spoke to many people, including Tina McBride, also Joyce had something to say about a very odd conversation concerning Debbie and how she felt about him. Tell us just about a couple of these kinds of conversations that kind of reinforced my idea that he's a very, very good suspect.
Well, the interesting thing about Joyce's statements to police about him was that she said that he would bring Debbie like little gifts and that he was very in love with her. And at one point when Debbie split up with him, he asked Joyce, he said, why doesn't she love me? And Joyce said, I don't know. Let me talk to her. So Joyce goes and talks to Debbie. And this is all in the police report. And Joyce says that when she asked Debbie about it, that, you know, she considered, you know, Paul just a friend to go do things with, like go to the movies or just hang out with. She didn't take it. She said, there's nothing about my relationship with him that is serious at all. So she didn't consider him a serious, like a viable, like boyfriend material. And he obviously viewed her much differently. Now, again, that doesn't prove anything in and of itself. Lots of people are, you know, attracted in to other people and they get rejected and it doesn't culminate with one of them being stabbed to death. But it is interesting that even Joyce back in 1975 was telling police. And I mean, and the thing about it is, when we're talking about like people that she dated, the police really were on him for a while. Like there's lots of reports of them interviewing him and what he said and all this other stuff. And the fact that he denied even dating her after being grilled by the police multiple times. See, Dan, that's the thing, is that 99% of the people in this world are never going to be called into an interrogation room and grilled in a murder case. I've never known anybody who didn't remember every detail of it. I mean, like vividly. Mm. And for him to even deny that he dated her, I thought was just, it was a little beyond the pale. And of course, and I was honest with him, you know, I told him, I said, look, we're looking at you. I mean, you know, it's, you know, you were a love interest of hers. Plus, I didn't tell him this, but he didn't know I had the police reports. So when he told us these, you know, fabrications, he didn't know that I already knew the truth. And so the fact that he just kept lying about all this stuff was really concerning. And we have expressed this to the Lubbock PD. You know, we sent them everything, all the stuff that the texter, all the text message that the texter sent us, and all this, the fact, like, Paul won't even take a call from anybody in Debbie's family. Like, they've repeatedly tried to call him and he won't return any of their calls. So all of this stuff taken together is very, very suspicious.
You talk also that when police asked why he might not want to have gone to take a shower while Debbie was there, despite them being friends, was that he said, well, we get along, but sometimes she ignores me. That was very, very strange. And also you write, you know, as a psychological profile, somewhat, 17 wounds, but she was posed face up. Mm-hmm. Many people wouldn't be able to handle that. So very, very angry person, evidently, with this as well. So with Paul Neal, what else do you think? What is your idea about him as a suspect?
This is whenever I get involved in one of these murder cases as an investigative journalist, what I try to do is we create a list of people, and we don't ever even call them a suspect. We call them people of interest, people who what could possibly have some connection, you know, to the murder victim, because 9 times out of 10, it's someone gets murdered by someone that is relatively close to them. So you're looking at family, friends, people in that sphere. And this is what I notice in all cases. You start investigating, and then somebody who, like in this case, we'll just use an example, Doug. Okay. When we started this, we're like, okay, so what if a waitress says he was at work all night? We don't believe that. We think he might not have been at work. He might have left and did this and went back to work. But then we start digging on Doug. And one question I asked Doug, I said, Doug, when you took the polygraph test, was there any question you failed? He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, I did fail one question. And I go, what question was that? And he goes, well, it was when they asked me if I killed her. And he said, but they told me that they said I would have to have failed a lot of other questions for that to be relevant. And so he answered it exactly the way a truthful person would, because if he was trying to conceal that, he just wouldn't tell us and we would have no way of knowing. So I told Jennifer afterwards, I said, he's telling the truth. Mm. And so that kind of leads us away from him because we know he's being truthful. Also, you know, as we dug in on him, like I said, we found other pieces of evidence that corroborated the fact that he stayed at work. So it got to the point where, okay, is it possible that Doug had it orchestrated or knew about it? Those things are all possible. But for him to directly be involved is now in the category of probably not. And so that's kind of how it goes. And so we were able to do that because things lined up, you know. Now you get to other people in other cases where things don't line up. In fact, as you drill down on them, things get more confusing and the lies and the stories and everything else get crazier. You know what I mean? Like they don't add up. And so a lot of things with Paul obviously don't add up. And it's not because a lot of it is his own doing, because he just wouldn't tell the truth.
So this investigation continues. As we said in the introduction, you believe this case is solvable and it's only just a matter of time. We didn't mention the podcast that you have, and Jennifer has a different podcast. Can you mention those podcasts and the Facebook page where the unsolved murder of Deborah Williamson? Tell us about ways that people might find out more about this case and about this book.
So we do two separate podcasts. I do a podcast called Diamond State Murder Board, and she does a podcast through AMU University called Break the Case. We do updates on both. The AMU podcast is a little bit more, we're in the Diamond State Murder Board podcast, we just have a conversation. you know, one-on-one conversation. We'll bring in experts like the knife expert we brought in, things like that. And we just play the whole conversation. AMU is a little bit more produced, I guess is the best way to put it. So they're different. Basically, we found that there's some people like the format that I use in Diamond State and other people like that format. So we do both ways. And then you can join our page, The Unsolved Murder of Deborah Sue Williamson. We post updates on that page. I don't want to say daily, but I'd say probably 3 to 4 times a week we post there. And we always have something new to talk about. We'll get a new witness. I talked to a lady that was friends with Paul and Debbie back in high school just a few weeks ago. And she didn't know about us. We didn't know about her. And so she called me up and we had probably a 2-hour long conversation. And she had some very vivid memories of both of them. And so that's kind of the connectivity that we get out of this. And that's what we're after. We just got to find that one person, Dan. There's somebody out there who knows enough to get justice for this woman, even after nearly half a century. And I tell people all the time, I covered a case one time that was 54 years old and a guy got arrested and he was in his late 60s, early 70s. And he went to prison for murdering this guy back in, I think it was 1964. So it can happen.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, George Jarrett, for coming on and talking about your new book, Silent Silhouette, Who Killed Deborah Sue? Thank you so much, George Jarrett. You have a great evening and good night.
Dan, you do the same. Thank you.
Thank you.